Outside, the dark air had cooled so that there was a chill in the room. It was almost dawn. The early morning sky was deep, silky blue, and the moon had turned from silver to white. All was still. The only sound was the clear, lonely song of a spring bird in the darkness outside. Though a faint breeze blew in from the window, the air in the room was sour and close. There was a feeling both of tenseness and exhaustion. Dr. Copeland leaned forward from the pillow. His eyes were bloodshot, and his hands clutched the counterpane. The neck of his nightshirt had slipped down over his bony shoulder. Jake's heels were balanced on the rungs of his chair, and his giant hands folded between his knees in a waiting and childlike attitude. Deep black circles were beneath his eyes. His hair was unkempt. They looked at each other and waited. As the silence grew longer, the tenseness between them became more strained. At last, Dr. Copeland cleared his throat and said, "I am certain you did not come here for nothing. I am sure we have not discussed these subjects all through the night, to no purpose. We have talked of everything now, except the most vital subject of all, the way out. What must be done?" They still watched each other and waited. In the face of each, there was expectation. Dr. Copeland sat bolt upright against the pillows. Jake rested his chin in his hand and leaned forward. The pause continued, and then, hesitantly, they began to speak at the same time.
"Excuse me," Jake said. "Go ahead." "No, you. You started first. Go on."
"Pshaw,"
said Dr. Copeland.
"Continue."
Jake stared at him with clouded, mystical eyes.
"It's this way. This is how I see it. The only solution is for the people to know. Once they know the truth, they can be oppressed no longer. Once just half of them know, the whole fight is won."
"Yes, once they understand the workings of this society. But how do you propose to tell them?"
"Listen," Jake said. "Think about chain letters. If one person sends a letter to 10 people, and then each of the 10 people sends letters to 10 more, you get it?"
He faltered.
"Not that I write letters, but the idea is the same. I just go around telling, and if in one town I can show the truth to just 10 of the don't-knows, then I feel like some good has been done, see?"
Dr. Copeland looked at Jake in surprise. Then he snorted.
"Do not be childish. You cannot just go about talking. Chain letters, indeed. Knows and don't knows."
Jake's lips trembled and his brow lowered with quick anger.
"Okay, what have you got to offer?"
"I will say first that I used to feel somewhat as you do on this question. But I have learned what a mistake that attitude is. For half a century, I thought it wise to be patient." "I didn't say be patient. In the face of brutality, I was prudent. Before injustice, I held my peace. I sacrificed the things in hand for the good of the hypothetical whole. I believed in the tongue instead of the fist. As an armor against oppression, I taught patience and faith in the human soul. I know now how wrong I was. I have been a traitor to myself and to my people. All that is rot. Now is the time to act, and to act quickly. Fight cunning with cunning and might with might."
"But how?" Jake asked. "How?"
"Why, by getting out and doing things. By calling crowds of people together and getting them to demonstrate."
"Oh, that last phrase gives you away.
Getting them to demonstrate? What good will it do if you get them to demonstrate against a thing if they don't know? You're trying to stuff the hog by way of his ass.
Such vulgar expressions annoy me, Dr. Copeland said prudishly.
For Christ's sake, I don't care if they annoy you or not.
Dr. Copeland held up his hand.
Let us not get so overheated, he said. Let us attempt to see eye to eye with each other. That suits me. I don't want to fight with you.
They were silent. Dr. Copeland moved his eyes from one corner of the ceiling to the other. Several times he wet his lips to speak, and each time the word remained half-formed and silent in his mouth. Then at last he said,
My advice to you is this. Do not attempt to stand alone.
But
nothing, said Dr. Copeland didactically. The most fatal thing a man can do is try to stand alone. I see what you're getting at.
Dr. Copeland pulled the neck of his nightshirt up over his bony shoulder and held it together tight to his throat.
You believe in the struggle of my people for their human rights?
The doctor's agitation and his mild and husky question made Jake's eyes brim suddenly with tears. A quick, swollen rush of love caused him to grasp the black, bony hand on the counterpane and hold it fast.
Sure, he said. The extremity of our need?
Yes.
The lack of justice? The bitter inequality?
Dr. Copeland coughed and spat into one of the squares of paper which he kept beneath his pillow.
I have a program. It is a very simple, concentrated plan. I mean to focus on only one objective. In August of this year, I plan to lead more than 1,000 Negroes in this county on a march. A march to Washington. All of us together in one solid body. If you will look in the cabinet yonder, you will see a stack of letters which I have written this week and will deliver personally.
Dr. Copeland slid his nervous hands up and down the sides of the narrow bed.
You remember what I said to you a short while ago? You will recall that my only advice to you was do not attempt to stand alone.
I get it, Jake said.
But once you enter this, it must be all. First and foremost, your work now and forever. You must give of your whole self, without stint, without hope of personal return, without rest or hope of rest. For the rights of the Negro in the South, and here in this very county, and it must be either all or nothing, either yes or no.
Dr. Copeland leaned back on the pillow. Only his eyes seemed alive. They burned in his face like red coals. The fever made his cheekbones a ghastly purple. Jake scowled and pressed his knuckles to his soft, wide, trembling mouth. Color rushed to his face. Outside, the first pale light of morning had come. The electric bulb suspended from the ceiling burned with ugly sharpness in the dawn. Jake rose to his feet and stood stiffly at the foot of the bed. He said flatly,
No, that's not the right angle at all. I'm dead sure it's not. In the first place, you'd never get out of town. They'd break it up by saying it's a menace to public health or some such trumped-up reason. They'd arrest you, and nothing would come of it. But even if by some miracle you got to Washington, it wouldn't do a bit of good. Why? The whole notion is crazy.
The sharp rattle of phlegm sounded in Dr. Copeland's throat. His voice was harsh.
As you are so quick to sneer and condemn, what do you have to offer instead?
I didn't sneer, Jake said. I only remarked that your plan is crazy. I come here tonight with an idea much better than that. I wanted your son Willie and the other two boys to let me push them around in a wagon.
They were to tell what happened to them, and afterward I was to tell why. In other words, I was to give a talk on the dialectics of capitalism and show up all of its lies. I would explain so that everyone would understand why those boys' legs were cut off and make everyone who saw them know. Pshaw. Double pshaw, said Dr. Copeland furiously. I do not believe you have good sense. If I were a man who felt it worth my while to laugh, I would surely laugh at that. Never have I had the opportunity to hear of such nonsense firsthand.
They stared at each other in bitter disappointment and anger. There was the rattle of a wagon in the street outside. Jake swallowed and bit his lips.
Ha, he said finally. You're the only one who's crazy. You got everything exactly backward. The only way to solve the Negro problem under capitalism is to geld every one of the 15 million black men in these states. So that is the kind of idea you harbor beneath your ranting about justice. I didn't say it should be done. I only said you couldn't see the forest for the trees.
Jake spoke with slow and painful care.
The work has to start at the bottom. The old traditions smashed, and the new ones created. To forge a whole new pattern for the world. To make man a social creature for the first time. Living in an orderly and controlled society where he is not forced to be unjust in order to survive. A social tradition in which...
Dr. Copeland clapped, ironically.
Very good, he said. But the cotton must be picked before the cloth is made. You and your crackpot do-nothing theories can... Hush! Who cares whether you and your 1,000 Negroes straggle up to that stinking cesspool of a place called Washington? What difference does it make? What do a few people matter? A few 1,000 people, black, white, good or bad? The whole of our society is built on a foundation of black lies. Everything, Dr. Copeland panted. Everything. Everything. Nothing. The soul of the meanest and most evil of us on this earth is worth more in the sight of justice than... Oh, the hell with it, Jake said. Balls! Blasphemer, screamed Dr. Copeland. Foul blasphemer!
Jake shook the iron bars of the bed. The vein in his forehead swelled to the point of bursting, and his face was dark with rage.
Short-sighted bigot! White!
Dr. Copeland's voice failed him. He struggled, and no sound would come. At last he was able to bring forth a choked whisper.
Fiend!
The bright yellow morning was at the window. Dr. Copeland's head fell back on the pillow. His neck twisted at a broken angle, a fleck of bloody foam on his lips. Jake looked at him once before, sobbing with violence, he rushed headlong from the room. 14. Now she could not stay in the inside room. She had to be around somebody all the time, doing something every minute. And if she was by herself, she counted or figured with numbers. She counted all the roses on the living room wallpaper. She figured out the cubic area of the whole house. She counted every blade of grass in the backyard and every leaf on a certain bush. Because if she did not have her mind on numbers, this terrible afraidness came in her. She would be walking home from school on these May afternoons, and suddenly she would have to think of something quick. A good thing, very good. Maybe she would think about a phrase of hurrying jazz music, or that a bowl of Jell-O would be in the refrigerator when she got home, or plan to smoke a cigarette behind the coal house. Maybe she would try to think a long way ahead to the time she would go north and see snow, or even travel somewhere in a foreign land. But these thoughts about good things wouldn't last. The Jell-O was gone in 5 minutes, and the cigarette smoked. Then what was there after that? And the numbers mixed themselves up in her brain, and the snow and the foreign land were a long, long time away. Then, what was there? Just Mr. Singer. She wanted to follow him everywhere. In the morning, she would watch him go down the front steps to work, and then follow along a half a block behind him. Every afternoon, as soon as school was over, she hung around at the corner near the store where he worked. At 4 o'clock, he went out to drink a Coca-Cola. She watched him cross the street and go into the drugstore and finally come out again. She followed him home from work and sometimes even when he took walks. She always followed a long way behind him, and he did not know. She would go up to see him in his room. First, she scrubbed her face and hands and put some vanilla on the front of her dress. She only went to see him twice a week now, because she didn't want him to get tired of her. Most always, he would be sitting over the queer, pretty chess game when she opened the door, and then she was with him. "Mr. Singer, have you ever lived in a place where it snowed in the wintertime?" He tilted his chair back against the wall and nodded. "In some different country than this one? In a foreign place?" He nodded yes again and wrote on his pad with his silver pencil. Once he had traveled to Ontario, Canada, across the river from Detroit. Canada was so far up north that the white snow drifted up to the roofs of the houses. That was where the Quints were, and the St. Lawrence River. The people ran up and down the streets speaking French to each other. And far up in the north there were deep forests and white ice igloos. The Arctic region with the beautiful northern lights. "When you was in Canada, did you go out and get any fresh snow and eat it with cream and sugar? Once I read where it was mighty good to eat that way." He turned his head to one side because he didn't understand. She couldn't ask the question again because suddenly it sounded silly. She only looked at him and waited. A big black shadow of his head was on the wall behind him. The electric fan cooled the thick, hot air. All was quiet. It was like they wanted to tell each other things that had never been told before. What she had to say was terrible and afraid, but what he would tell her was so true that it would make everything all right. Maybe it was a thing that could not be spoken with words or writing. Maybe he would have to let her understand this in a different way. That was the feeling she had with him. "I was just asking you about Canada, but it didn't amount to anything, Mr. Singer." Downstairs, in the homerooms, there was plenty of trouble. Etta was still so sick that she couldn't sleep, crowded three in a bed. The shades were drawn and the dark room smelled bad with a sick smell. Etta's job was gone, and that meant $8 less a week, besides the doctor's bill. Then one day, when Ralph was walking around in the kitchen, he burned himself on the hot kitchen stove. The bandages made his hands itch, and somebody had to watch him all the time, else he would bust the blisters. On George's birthday, they had bought him a little red bike with a bell and a basket on the handlebars. Everybody had chipped in to give it to him. But when Etta lost her job, they couldn't pay. And after two installments were past due, the store sent a man out to take the wheel away. George just watched the man roll the bike off the porch, and when he passed, George kicked the back fender and then went into the coal house and shut the door. It was money, money, money all the time. They owed to the grocery, and they owed the last payment on some furniture. And now, since they had lost the house, they owed money there, too. The six rooms in the house were always taken, but nobody ever paid the rent on time. For a while, their dad went out every day to hunt another job. He couldn't do carpenter work anymore because it made him jittery to be more than 10 feet off the ground. He applied for many jobs, but nobody would hire him. Then at last, he got this notion. "It's advertising, Mick," he said. "I've come to the conclusion that it's all in the world the matter with my watch repairing business right now. I gotta sell myself. I gotta get out and let people know I can fix watches and fix them good and cheap. You just mark my words, I'm gonna build up this business so I'll be able to make a good living for this family the rest of my life. Just by advertising." He brought home a dozen sheets of tin and some red paint. For the next week, he was very busy. It seemed to him like this was a hell of a good idea. The signs were all over the floor of the front room. He got down on his hands and knees and took great care over the printing of each letter. As he worked, he whistled and wagged his head. He hadn't been so cheerful and glad in months. Every now and then, he would have to dress in his good suit and go around the corner for a glass of beer to calm himself. On the signs at first, he had, Wilbur Kelly, watch repairing, very cheap and expert. Mick, I want them to hit you right bang in the eye, to stand out wherever you see them. She helped him, and he gave her 3 nickels. The signs were okay at first. Then he worked on them so much that they were ruined. He wanted to add more and more things in the corners and at the top and bottom. Before he had finished, the signs were plastered all over with very cheap and come at once and you give me any watch and I make it run. You tried to write so much in the signs that nobody will read anything, she told him. He brought home some more tin and left the designing up to her. She painted them very plain, with great big block letters and a picture of a clock. Soon he had a whole stack of them. A fellow he knew rode him out in the country where he could nail them to trees and fence posts. At both ends of the block, he put up a sign with a black hand pointing toward the house, and over the front door, there was another sign. The day after this advertising was finished, he waited in the front room, dressed in a clean shirt and tie. Nothing happened. The jeweler, who gave him overflow work to do at half price, sent in a couple of clocks. That was all. He took it hard. He didn't go out to look for other jobs anymore, but every minute he had to be busy around the house. He took down the doors and oiled the hinges, whether they needed it or not. He mixed some margarine for Portia and scrubbed the floor upstairs. He worked out a contraption where the water from the icebox could be drained through the kitchen window. He carved some beautiful alphabet blocks for Ralph and invented a little needle threader. Over the few watches that he had to work on, he took great pains. Mick still followed Mr. Singer, but she didn't want to. It was like there was something wrong about her following after him without his knowing. 2 or 3 days she played hooky from school. She walked behind him when he went to work and hung around on the corner near his store all day. When he ate his dinner at Mr. Brannan's, she went into the cafe and spent a nickel for a sack of peanuts. Then at night, she followed him on these dark, long walks. She stayed on the opposite side of the street from him and about a block behind. When he stopped, she stopped also. And when he walked fast, she ran to keep up with him. So long as she could see him and be near him, she was right happy. But sometimes this queer feeling would come to her, and she knew that she was doing wrong, so she tried hard to keep busy at home. She and her dad were alike in the way that now they always had to be fooling with something. She kept up with all that went on in the house and the neighborhood. Spare Rib's big sister won $50 at a movie bank night. Baby Wilson had the bandage off her head now, but her hair was cut short like a boy's. She couldn't dance in the soiree this year, and when her mother took her to see it, Baby began to yell and cut up during one of the dances. They had to drag her out of the opera house. And on the sidewalk, Mrs. Wilson had to whip her to make her behave. And Mrs. Wilson cried, too. George hated Baby. He would hold his nose and stop up his ears when she passed by the house. Pete Wells ran away from home and was gone 3 weeks. He came back barefooted and very hungry. He bragged about how he had gone all the way to New Orleans. Because of Etta, Mick still slept in the living room. The short sofa cramped her so much that she had to make up sleep in study hall at school. Every other night, Bill swapped with her and she slept with George. Then a lucky break came for them. A fellow who had a room upstairs moved away. When after a week had gone by and nobody answered the ad in the paper, their mama told Bill he could move up to the vacant room. Bill was very pleased to have a place entirely by himself, away from the family. She moved in with George. He slept like a little warm kitty and breathed very quiet. She knew the nighttime again, but not the same as in the last summer when she walked in the dark by herself and listened to the music and made plans. She knew the night a different way now. In bed, she lay awake. A queer afraidness came to her. It was like the ceiling was slowly pressing down toward her face. How would it be if the house fell apart? Once their dad had said the whole place ought to be condemned. Did he mean that maybe some night when they were asleep, the walls would crack and the house collapse? Bury them under all the plaster and broken glass and smashed furniture so that they could not move or breathe? She lay awake and her muscles were stiff. In the night, there was creaking. Was that somebody walking? Somebody else awake besides her? Mr. Singer? She never thought about Harry. She had made up her mind to forget him, and she did forget him. He wrote that he had a job with a garage in Birmingham. She answered with a card saying, okay, as they had planned. He sent his mother $3 every week. It seemed like a very long time had passed since they went to the woods together. During the day, she was busy in the outside room, but at night, she was by herself in the dark, and figuring was not enough. She wanted somebody. She tried to keep George awake. It sure is fun to stay awake and talk in the dark. Let's just talk a while together. He made a sleepy answer. See the stars out the window? It's a hard thing to realize that every single one of those little stars is a planet as large as the Earth. How do they know that? They just do. They got ways of measuring. That's science. I don't believe it. She tried to egg him on to an argument so that he would get mad and stay awake. He just let her talk and didn't seem to pay attention. After a while, he said, look, Mick. You see that branch of the tree? Don't it look like a pilgrim forefather lying down with a gun in his hand? It sure does. That's exactly what it's like. And see over there on the bureau? Don't that bottle look like a funny man with a hat on? Nah, George said. It don't look a bit like one to me. She took a drink from a glass of water on the floor. Let's me and you play a game. The name game. You can be it if you want to. Whichever you like, you can choose. He put his little fists up to his face and breathed in a quiet, even way because he was falling asleep. Wait, George, she said. This'll be fun. I'm somebody beginning with an M. Guess who I am? George sighed and his voice was tired. Are ye Harpo Marx? No, I'm not even in the movies. I don't know. Sure you do. My name begins with the letter M, and I live in Italy. You ought to guess this. George turned over on his side and curled up in a ball. He did not answer. My name begins with an M, but sometimes I'm called a name beginning with D. In Italy. You can guess. The room was quiet and dark, and George was asleep. She pinched him and twisted his ear. He groaned, but did not awake. She fitted in close to him and pressed her face against his hot little naked shoulder. He would sleep all through the night while she was figuring with decimals. Was Mr. Singer awake in his room upstairs? Did the ceiling creak because he was walking quietly up and down, drinking a cold orange crush and studying the chessmen laid out on the table? Had ever he felt a terrible afraidness like this one? No. He had never done anything wrong. He had never done wrong, and his heart was quiet in the night time. Yet at the same time, he would understand. If only she could tell him about this, then it would be better. She thought of how she would begin to tell him. Mr. Singer, I know this girl not any older than I am. Mr. Singer, I don't know whether you understand a thing like this or not. Mr. Singer. Mr. Singer. She said his name over and over. She loved him better than anyone in the family, better even than George or her dad. It was a different love. It was not like anything she had ever felt in her life before. In the morning, she and George would dress together and talk. Sometimes she wanted very much to be close to George. He had grown taller and was pale and peaked. His soft reddish hair lay raggedly over the tops of his little ears. His sharp eyes were always squinted so that his face had a strained look. His permanent teeth were coming in, but they were blue and far apart like his baby teeth had been. Often his jaw was crooked because he had a habit of feeling out the sore new teeth with his tongue. "Listen here, George," she said. "Do you love me?"
"Sure. I'll love you, okay?"
It was a hot sunny morning during the last week of school. George was dressed and he lay on the floor doing his number work. His dirty little fingers squeezed the pencil tight, and he kept breaking the lead point. When he was finished, she held him by the shoulders and looked hard into his face.
"I mean a lot. A whole lot. Let me go. Sure I love you, ain't you my sister?"
"I know, but suppose I wasn't your sister, would you love me then?" George backed away. He had run out of shirts and wore a dirty pullover sweater. His wrists were thin and blue-veined. The sleeves of the sweater had stretched so that they hung loose and made his hands look very small.
"If you wasn't my sister, then I might not know you, so I couldn't love you.
But if you did know me, and I wasn't your sister..."
"But how do you know I would? You can't prove it."
"Well, just take it for granted and pretend."
"I reckon I would like you all right, but I still say you can't prove..." "Prove? You got that word on the brain. Prove and trick. Everything is either a trick or it's got to be proved. I can't stand you, George Kelly. I hate you."
"Okay, then I don't like you none either."
He crawled down under the bed for something. "What do you want under there? You better leave my things alone. If I ever caught you meddling in my private box, I'd bust your head against the side of the wall, I would. I'd stomp on your brains." George came out from under the bed with his spelling book. His dirty little paw reached in a hole in the mattress where he hid his marbles. Nothing could faze that kid. He took his time about choosing three brown agates to take with him.
"Ah, shucks, Mick," he answered her.
George was too little and too tough. There wasn't any sense in loving him. He knew even less about things than she did. School was out, and she had passed every subject, some with A+, and some by the skin of her teeth. The days were long and hot. Finally, she was able to work hard at music again. She began to write down pieces for the violin and piano. She wrote songs. Always, music was in her mind. She listened to Mr. Singer's radio and wandered around the house thinking about the program she had heard.
"What ails Mick?" Portia asked. "What kind of cat is it got her tongue? She walk around and don't say a word. She not even greedy like she used to be. She getting to be a regular lady these days."
It was as though, in some way, she was waiting. But what she waited for, she did not know. The sun burned down glaring and white hot in the streets. During the day, she either worked hard at music or messed with kids, and waited. Sometimes she would look all around her quick, and this panic would come in her. Then in late June, there was a sudden happening so important that it changed everything. That night, they were all out on the porch. The twilight was blurred and soft. Supper was almost ready, and the smell of cabbage floated to them from the open hall. All of them were together except Hazel, who had not come home from work, and Etta, who still lay sick in bed. Their dad leaned back in a chair with his sock feet on the banisters. Bill was on the steps with the kids. Their mama sat on the swing, fanning herself with the newspaper. Across the street, a girl, new in the neighborhood, skated up and down the sidewalk on one roller skate. The lights on the block were just beginning to be turned on, and far away, a man was calling someone. Then Hazel came home. Her high heels clopped up the steps, and she leaned back lazily on the banisters. In the half-dark, her fat, soft hands were very white as she felt the back of her braided hair.
"I sure do wish Etta was able to work," she said. "I found out about this job today."
"What kind of job?" asked their dad. "Anything I could do, or just for girls?"
"Just for a girl. A clerk down at Woolworth's is going to get married next week."
"The 10-cent store?" Mick said.
"You interested?"
The question took her by surprise. She had just been thinking about a sack of wintergreen candy she had bought there the day before. She felt hot and tense. She rubbed her bangs up from her forehead and counted the first few stars. Their dad flipped his cigarette down to the sidewalk.
No, he said. We don't want Mick to take on too much responsibility at her age. Let her get her growth out. Her growth through with, anyway.
I agree with you, Hazel said. I really do think it would be a mistake for Mick to have to work regular. I don't think it would be right.
Bill put Ralph down from his lap and shuffled his feet on the steps.
Nobody ought to work until they're around 16. Mick should have 2 more years and finish it vocational, if we can make it.
Even if we have to give up the house and move down in Milltown, their mama said, I'd rather keep Mick at home for a while. For a minute, she had been scared they would try to corner her into taking the job. She would have said she would run away from home. But the way they took the attitude they did touched her. She felt excited. They were all talking about her, and in a kindly way. She was ashamed for the first scared feeling that had come to her. Of a sudden, she loved all of the family, and a tightness came in her throat.
About how much money is in it? She asked.
$10.
$10 a week?
Sure, Hazel said. Did you think it would only be 10 a month?
Portia don't make but about that much.
Oh, colored people, Hazel said. Mick rubbed the top of her head with her fist.
That's a whole lot of money. A good deal.
It's not to be grinned at, Bill said. That's what I make.
Mick's tongue was dry. She moved it around in her mouth to gather up spit enough to talk.
$10 a week would buy about 15 fried chickens, or 5 pairs of shoes, or 5 dresses, or installments on a radio.
She thought about a piano, but she did not mention that aloud.
It would tide us over, their mama said, but at the same time, I'd rather keep Mick at home for a while. Now, when Etta...
Wait! She felt hot and reckless. I want to take the job. I can hold it down, I know I can.
Listen to little Mick, Bill said.
Their dad picked his teeth with a matchstick and took his feet down from the banisters.
Now, let's not rush into anything. I'd rather Mick take her time and think this out. We can get along somehow without her working. I mean to increase my watch work by 60% soon as I...
I forgot, Hazel said. I think there's a Christmas bonus every year.
Mick frowned.
But I wouldn't be working then. I'd be in school. I just want to work during vacation and then go back to school.
Sure,
Hazel said quickly. But tomorrow I'll go down with you and take the job if I can get it. It was as though a great worry and tightness left the family. In the dark, they began to laugh and talk. Their dad did a trick for George with a matchstick and a handkerchief. Then he gave the kid 50 cents to go down to the corner store for Coca-Colas to be drunk after supper. The smell of cabbage was stronger in the hall, and pork chops were frying. Portia called. The boarders already waited at the table. Mick had supper in the dining room. The cabbage leaves were limp and yellow on her plate, and she couldn't eat. When she reached for the bread, she knocked a pitcher of iced tea over the table. Then later, she waited on the front porch by herself for Mr. Singer to come home. In a desperate way, she wanted to see him. The excitement of the hour before had died down, and she was sick to the stomach. She was going to work in a 10-cent store, and she did not want to work there. It was like she had been trapped into something. The job wouldn't be just for the summer, but for a long time, as long as she could see ahead. Once they were used to the money coming in, it would be impossible to do without again. That was the way things were. She stood in the dark and held tight to the banisters. A long time passed, and Mr. Singer still did not come. At 11 o'clock, she went out to see if she could find him. But suddenly, she got frightened in the dark and ran back home. Then in the morning, she bathed and dressed very careful. Hazel and Etta loaned her the clothes to wear and primped her to look nice. She wore Hazel's green silk dress and a green hat and high-heeled pumps with silk stockings. They fixed her face with rouge and lipstick and plucked her eyebrows. She looked at least 16 years old when they were finished. It was too late to back down now. She was really grown and ready to earn her keep. Yet if she would go to her dad and tell him how she felt, he would tell her to wait a year, And Hazel and Etta and Bill and their mama even now would say that she didn't have to go. But she couldn't do it. She couldn't lose face like that. She went up to see Mr. Singer. The words came all in a rush.
Listen, I believe I got this job. What do you think? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's okay to drop out of school and work now? You think it's good?
At first, he did not understand. His gray eyes half closed, and he stood with his hands deep in his pockets. There was the old feeling that they waited to tell each other things that had never been told before. The thing she had to say now was not much, but what he had to tell her would be right. And if he said the job sounded okay, then she would feel better about it. She repeated the words slowly and waited.
You think it's good?
Mr. Singer considered. Then he nodded, yes. She got the job. The manager took her and Hazel back to a little office and talked with them. Afterward, she couldn't remember how the manager looked or anything that had been said. But she was hired, and on the way out of the place, she bought 10 cents worth of chocolate and a little modeling clay set for George. On June the 5th, she was to start work. She stood for a long while before the window of Mr. Singer's jewelry store. Then she hung around on the corner. 15. The time had come for Singer to go to Antonopolis again. The journey was a long one, for although the distance between them was something less than 200 miles, the train meandered to points far out of the way and stopped for long hours at certain stations during the night. Singer would leave the town in the afternoon and travel all through the night and until the early morning of the next day. As usual, he was ready far in advance. He planned to have a full week with his friend this visit. His clothes had been sent to the cleaners, his hat blocked, and his bags were in readiness. The gifts he would carry were wrapped in colored tissue paper, and in addition, there was a deluxe basket of fruits done up in cellophane and a crate of late-shipped strawberries. On the morning before his departure, Singer cleaned his room. In his icebox, he found a bit of leftover goose liver and took it out to the alley for the neighborhood cat. On his door, he tacked the same sign he had posted there before, stating that he would be absent for several days on business. During all these preparations, he moved about leisurely with two vivid spots of color on his cheekbones. His face was very solemn. Then at last the hour for departure was at hand. He stood on the platform, burdened with his suitcases and gifts, and watched the train roll in on the station tracks. He found himself a seat in the day coach and hoisted his luggage on the rack above his head. The car was crowded for the most part with mothers and children. The green plush seats had a grimy smell. The windows of the car were dirty, and rice thrown at some recent bridal pair lay scattered on the floor. Singer smiled cordially to his fellow travelers and leaned back in his seat. He closed his eyes. The lashes made a dark, curved fringe above the hollows of his cheeks. His right hand moved nervously inside his pocket. For a while, his thoughts lingered in the town he was leaving behind him. He saw Mick and Dr. Copeland and Jake Blunt and Biff Brannan. The faces crowded in on him out of the darkness so that he felt smothered. He thought of the quarrel between Blunt and the Negro. The nature of this quarrel was hopelessly confused in his mind, but each of them had on several occasions broken out into a bitter tirade against the other, the absent one. He had agreed with each of them in turn, though what it was they wanted him to sanction he did not know. And Mick, her face was urgent, and she said a good deal that he did not understand in the least. And then Biff Brannan at the New York Cafe. Brannan with his dark, iron-like jaw and his watchful eyes. And strangers who followed him about the streets and buttonholed him for unexplainable reasons. The Turk at the linen shop who flung his hands up in his face and babbled with his tongue to make words the shape of which Singer had never imagined before. A certain mill foreman and an old black woman. A businessman on the main street, and an urchin who solicited soldiers for a whorehouse near the river. Singer wriggled his shoulders uneasily. The train rocked with a smooth, easy motion. His head nodded to rest on his shoulder, and for a short while, he slept. When he opened his eyes again, the town was far behind him. The town was forgotten. Outside the dirty window, there was the brilliant midsummer countryside. The sun slanted in strong, bronze-colored rays over the green fields of the new cotton. There were acres of tobacco, the plants heavy and green like some monstrous jungle weed. The orchards of peaches with the lush fruit waiting down the dwarfed trees. There were miles of pastures and tens of miles of wasted, washed-out land abandoned to the hardier weeds. The train cut through deep green pine forest where the ground was covered with the slick brown needles and the tops of the trees stretched up, virgin and tall, into the sky. And farther, a long way south of the town, the cypress swamps, with the gnarled roots of the trees writhing down into the brackish waters, where the gray, tattered moss trailed from the branches, where tropical waterflowers blossomed in dankness and gloom. Then out again into the open, beneath the sun and the indigo blue sky. Singer sat solemn and timid, his face turned fully toward the window. The great sweeps of space and the hard elemental coloring almost blinded him. This kaleidoscopic variety of scene, this abundance of growth and color, seemed somehow connected with his friend. His thoughts were with Antonopoulos. The bliss of their reunion almost stifled him. His nose was pinched, and he breathed with quick, short breaths through his slightly opened mouth. Antonopoulos would be glad to see him. He would enjoy the fresh fruits in the presence. By now he would be out of the sick ward and able to go on an excursion to the movies, and afterward to the hotel where they had eaten dinner on the first visit. Singer had written many letters to Antonopoulos, but he had not posted them. He surrendered himself wholly to thoughts of his friend. The half-year since he had last been with him seemed neither a long nor a short span of time. Behind each waking moment there had always been his friend, and this submerged communion with Antonopoulos had grown and changed as though they were together in the flesh. Sometimes he thought of Antonopoulos with awe and self-abasement, sometimes with pride, always with love unchecked by criticism, freed of will. When he dreamed at night, the face of his friend was always before him, massive and gentle, and in his waking thoughts, they were eternally united. The summer evening came slowly. The sun sank down behind a ragged line of trees in the distance, and the sky paled. The twilight was languid and soft. There was a white full moon, and low purple clouds lay over the horizon. The earth, the trees, the unpainted rural dwellings darkened slowly. At intervals, mild summer lightning quivered in the air. Singer watched all of this intently until at last the night had come, and his own face was reflected in the glass before him. Children staggered up and down the aisle of the car with dripping paper cups of water. An old man in overalls who had the seat before Singer drank whiskey from time to time from a Coca-Cola bottle. Between swallows, he plugged the bottle carefully with a wad of paper. A little girl on the right combed her hair with a sticky red lollipop. Shoeboxes were opened and trays of supper were brought in from the dining car. Singer did not eat. He leaned back in his seat and kept a desultory account of all that went on around him. At last the car settled down. Children lay on the broad plush seats and slept, while men and women doubled up with their pillows and rested as best they could. Singer did not sleep. He pressed his face close against the glass and strained to see into the night. The darkness was heavy and velvety. Sometimes there was a patch of moonlight or the flicker of a lantern from the window of some house along the way. From the moon, he saw that the train had turned from its southward course and was headed toward the east. The eagerness he felt was so keen that his nose was too pinched to breathe through, and his cheeks were scarlet. He sat there, his face pressed close against the cold, sooty glass of the window, through most of the long night journey. The train was more than an hour late, and the fresh, bright summer morning was well underway when they arrived. Singer went immediately to the hotel, a very good hotel where he had made reservations in advance. He unpacked his bags and arranged the presents he would take to Antonopoulos on the bed. From the menu the bellboy brought him, he selected a luxurious breakfast, broiled bluefish, hominy, French toast, and hot black coffee. After breakfast, he rested before the electric fan in his underwear. At noon, he began to dress. He bathed and shaved and laid out fresh linen in his best seersucker suit. At 3 o'clock, the hospital was open for visiting hours. It was Tuesday and the 18th of July. At the asylum, he sought Antonopoulos first in the sick ward where he had been confined before, but at the doorway of the room he saw immediately that his friend was not there. Next he found his way through the corridors to the office where he had been taken the time before. He had his question already written on one of the cards he carried about with him. The person behind the desk was not the same as the one who had been there before. He was a young man, almost a boy, with a half-formed, immature face and a lank mop of hair. Singer handed him the card and stood quietly, his arms heaped with packages, his weight resting on his heels. The young man shook his head. He leaned over the desk and scribbled loosely on a pad of paper. Singer read what he had written, and the spots of color drained from his cheekbones instantly. He looked at the note a long time, his eyes cut sideways and his head bowed. For it was written there that Antonopoulos was dead. On the way back to the hotel, he was careful not to crush the fruit he had brought with him. He took the packages up to his room and then wandered down to the lobby. Behind a potted palm tree, there was a slot machine. He inserted a nickel, but when he tried to pull the lever, he found that the machine was jammed. Over this incident, he made a great to-do. He cornered the clerk and furiously demonstrated what had happened. His face was deathly pale, and he was so beside himself that tears rolled down the ridges of his nose. He flailed his hands and even stamped once with his long, narrow, elegantly shoed foot on the plush carpet. Nor was he satisfied when his coin was refunded, but insisted on checking out immediately. He packed his bag and was obliged to work energetically to make it close again. For in addition to the articles he had brought with him, he carried away 3 towels, 2 cakes of soap, a pen and a bottle of ink, a roll of toilet paper, and a holy Bible. He paid his bill and walked to the railway station to put his belongings in custody. The train did not leave until 9 in the evening, and he had the empty afternoon before him. This town was smaller than the one in which he lived. The business streets intersected to form the shape of a cross. The stores had a countrified look. There were harnesses and sacks of feed in half of the display windows. Singer walked listlessly along the sidewalks. His throat felt swollen, and he wanted to swallow but was unable to do so. To relieve this strangled feeling, he bought a drink in one of the drugstores. He idled in the barbershop and purchased a few trifles at the 10-cent store. He looked no one full in the face, and his head drooped down to one side like a sick animal's. The afternoon was almost ended when a strange thing happened to Singer. He had been walking slowly and irregularly along the curb of the street. The sky was overcast and the air humid. Singer did not raise his head, but as he passed the town pool room, he caught a sideways glance of something that disturbed him. He passed the pool room, and then he stopped in the middle of the street. Listlessly, he retraced his steps and stood before the open door of the place. There were 3 mutes inside, and they were talking with their hands together. All 3 of them were coatless. They wore bowler hats and bright ties. Each of them held a glass of beer in his left hand. There was a certain brotherly resemblance between them. Singer went inside. For a moment he had trouble taking his hand from his pocket. Then clumsily, he formed a word of greeting. He was clapped on the shoulder. A cold drink was ordered.
They surrounded him, and the fingers of their hands shot out like pistons as they questioned him. He told his own name and the name of the town where he lived. After that, he could think of nothing else to tell about himself. He asked if they knew Spiros Antonopoulos. They did not know him. Singer stood with his hands dangling loose. His head was still inclined to one side, and his glance was oblique. He was so listless and cold that the three mutes in the bowler hats looked at him queerly. After a while, they left him out of the conversation, and when they had paid for the rounds of beers and were ready to depart, they did not suggest that he join them. Although Singer had been adrift on the streets for half a day, he almost missed his train. It was not clear to him how this happened or how he had spent the hours before. He reached the station 2 minutes before the train pulled out and barely had time to drag his luggage aboard and find a seat. The car he chose was almost empty. When he was settled, he opened the crate of strawberries and picked them over with finicky care. The berries were of a giant size, large as walnuts and in full-blown ripeness. The green leaves at the top of the rich-colored fruit were like tiny bouquets. Singer put a berry in his mouth, and though the juice had a lush, wild sweetness, there was already a subtle flavor of decay. He ate until his palate was dulled by the taste, and then rewrapped the crate and placed it on the rack above him. At midnight, he drew the window shade and lay down on the seat. He was curled in a ball, his coat pulled over his face and head. In this position, he lay in a stupor of half-sleep for about 12 hours. The conductor had to shake him when they arrived. Singer left his luggage in the middle of the station floor. Then he walked to the shop. He greeted the jeweler, for whom he worked, with a listless turn of his head. When he went out again, there was something heavy in his pocket. For a while, he rambled with bent head along the streets. But the unrefracted brilliance of the sun, the humid heat oppressed him. He returned to his room with swollen eyes and an aching head. After resting, he drank a glass of iced coffee and smoked a cigarette. Then when he had washed the ashtray and the glass, he brought out a pistol from his pocket and put a bullet in his chest.